The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Kingdom, though we're a little flock, we should rejoice that you've given us the kingdom and that we have been made as members of your church, both the community of the kingdom and agents of your kingdom in the world. We pray that you would enable us to better understand the world that you have sent us to as your ambassadors. And we ask this now in Jesus' name. Amen. All righty, let me remind you of what we're doing. We're looking this week really at the context. The whole rest of this course is going to be talking about what is the church. But you're not going to be able to appreciate what the church is unless you have a good grasp on the kind of world that the church is facing now. Now, we're going through that now. As I said, I think last time, the early apostles, for example, did not really understand what Jesus had told them about world missions until the Holy Spirit broke out with this at Samaria. And then they said, maybe we're not supposed to just go to the Jews. In other words, they had exegeted Christ's words wrongly. And what happened was events in the world helped them to understand better what the church was supposed to be. It is wrong to say that the world sets the agenda for the church. I think it's wrong to say that. There's a lot of folks that say it. It's a great slogan that the world sets the agenda for the church. No. But God sets the agenda for the church. Often, many times in history you can see, God sets the agenda for the church through world events. I've seen it many times. The Samaria thing I just mentioned, for example, last time we were talking about the poor. There's no doubt that again and again, whenever revivals broke out amongst the poor, the church suddenly realized that they weren't reaching the poor. They realized they weren't reaching the poor because all these poor Christians came flooding into the churches and they realized that they didn't fit. You can see that in the Great Awakening. You can see that in the Methodist movement. So the point is, the world doesn't set the agenda for the church, but the church, that God sets the agenda for the church very often through world events. We have to understand that. And that's the reason why, though, on Friday, I am going to talk to you some about some of the implications of what we're talking about last Monday and today for the doctrine of the church. But basically, I'm trying to set a stage. I'm hoping that as you go through and you listen to the lecturers come through, and they say, the church is the people of God, the church is the dwelling place of God, the church is the fellowship of the Spirit, you see. The church is both organism and organization. The church is both visible and invisible. And as they go through, if you've got in your mind the world that we're facing, at points you're going to say, yes. Now, we haven't practiced that much. That's true about the church. I've always known that, but we don't practice that much. And how much more are we going to have to practice that and come to grips with that in light of the challenge that is facing us? See, so the way in which you study would be different if you know the world that we're looking at. Now, I have rearranged all those. I told you last time 13 trends that I wanted to talk to you about. And if I give a trend and then say questions, I realize this isn't going to work. So I've re-outlined those trends, as you can see, I think, from here. We've already talked about this one. In the third world, there's a great explosion, population explosion. There's a lot of upheaval. And we talked about the fact that the results of all that is the rapid ethnicization of America, ethnicizing of America, urbanization of the world, that third world cities are exploding. It used to be that the so-called industrialized nations used to be so proud that the biggest cities were in the industrialized nations, and of course that's not any longer true. We talked about the migration of the disenfranchised, that the poor are moving back and forth from country to cities, from country to country, in enormous numbers. We talked about that. We talked about the shift of the Christian center to the south, that most of the Christians of the world are now or soon will be in the third world. We talked about political fragmentation and the growth of totalitarianism. Not necessarily communism, but totalitarianism is surely growing. We talked about that. Now, having done that and talked about the third world, I'm trying to focus now more on the Western or the so-called developed countries, mainly the United States and Europe and even the Soviet Union. Is what we mean when we talk about what I'm talking about actually even affects the Soviet Union, though to some degree less. Basically, these three things I'm going to talk about now really are effects that happen not just in America and not just in Europe, but even in the communist bloc, the so-called second world, you know, the first world, second world, third world idea. In a sense, I'm going to be talking to you about the industrialized countries today. And I began talking about them, and I said, first of all, I'd like to talk to you about two or three words that have to do with, I think they are descriptions of the modern worldview. I'll talk to you in a minute about why I use the word worldview, though it may be not in the same way you usually use it. Let's get back. I started this, now I really want to hit it. Secularization, privatization, and pluralization. The three words I get from Oz Guinness's book, Gravedigger File, which is pretty interesting and helpful, but the best way to read that book is to read his footnotes, find the books that he got the ideas from, and read those books as well. And then you've got a real course, a real good reading course on your hands. Let's talk about this. Secularization. We said, and I'll say it again, this is the worldview. It's carried like a virus. It's not the same thing as secularism. Secularism is a thoroughgoing creed that says there is no God, or if there is a God, he is not involved in the world, there is no supernatural, there is no life after death, and so on. Secularization is the worldview that says that religion is for the private realm, that there's no absolute truth for the central public sectors, and by that I mean, I can turn this off for a second, public sectors mean science, technology, corporate business, education, government, and the media, okay? Education, I mentioned that. Some examples of this, how is it carried? It's not an intellectual so much process, secularization, it's a social process as well, you see. You pick it up in many ways. You pick it up through the media, of course, but you also pick it up through bureaucracy. Somebody said bureaucracy is just technology applied to human organization. In professionalism, the concept of professionalism is that you never inject your personal beliefs ever into your work, nor does your private life and your private beliefs have really anything to do with your professional work. I the last two nights, I must confess, I watched the Hill Street Blues. They've started on Channel 17 to show all the, Hill Street Blues. I guess Monday night was the first episode from way back in whenever it started. What was that, 1978, something like that? And it's so intriguing. Joyce Davenport, you know, the feminist fantasy, the lawyer, beautiful lady lawyer who's tough as nails and brilliant and beautiful and everything. Last night, at one point, she was in a bar and there was another lawyer. Her boyfriend is a police officer, okay, Frank, right? She's there and he's watching another lawyer try to make it sort of a deal with her. Hey, do this for me, in court, do this for me. And he tries to slip her some drugs as a kind of thank you. Ferrillo pulls back his badge. The guy runs out. She says, how you have embarrassed me. Anybody see that last night? She says, of course not. You've got this course, right? You were working on it. Okay. How you've embarrassed me. And he says, I kept you from committing a felony. And she got in the car and says, I know how to keep my private life and my professional life separate. In other words, the law is for the public, you know, even the law, ethics of any sort, are for the public arena only, you see. I mentioned yesterday, for example, that there was an NBC executive that Oz Guinness quotes in his book that says, now that I'm a born-again Christian, it doesn't change the way I'm doing programming. It just gives me peace and satisfaction in my private life, you see. This is one of the reasons why that the born-again phenomenon has grown, why there is more and more and more people in this country, huge numbers of people that insist they've had a born-again experience and have all the basic, look, they have all the basic creeds. When you ask them, do you believe in God? Do you believe the Bible is the Word of God? Do you believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Do you believe in a heaven and hell? It's astonishing the number of people in the country that believe that. Now, that's not secularism, is it? And yet, as far as that belief having much bearing on the way people actually live in society, public morality and so on, it hasn't made a dent. People are wondering about that, you see. in Great Britain in the Great Awakening, when thousands of people became Christians, when they were born again, it had a tremendous impact. As many historians say, if it wasn't for the Great Awakening, England would have gone through what France went through, you know, a bloody revolution. But it had an enormous impact on society. It had an enormous impact on care for the poor. It had an enormous impact it led to the abolition of slavery. It led to the repeal of child labor laws. It led to prison reform and all sorts of things like that. That's not true here. Why? Secularization. Peter Berger, a sociologist, explains secularization like this. Secularization, he says, is a very distinctive mindset. Very distinctive. It's new and it's distinctively modern. All worldviews used to see ordinary life as one room or an antechamber in a much bigger world. Okay, it was a vaster, a very real world full of divine realities, and ordinary life was one room in that world. And it's our institutions in ordinary life, our ethics, our values came from the larger world, you see, and the larger world judged ordinary life, you see. What made that room meaningful was its place in the larger world. But Peter Berger says that larger world, secularization, means that the common sense world is a world without windows. Now that's a very, very interesting way to put it, and that's exactly right. Ordinary life is the only reality. If there is anything else out there, it's a concrete slab, you see, around ordinary life, and we have no idea what is out there. Truth, reality, God, beauty, those sorts of things. You see, we don't know. Nothing judges it from the outside. A common sense life, Berger says, is a world without windows. Now, that leads to, and these are concomitant, actually, they go together. That's the reason why sometimes I stick them together when talking about it. If religion has no place in the public arena, where does it? Does it have no place at all? And the answer is it does, in the private world. And let me, again, I'll go back to Berger for a minute, Peter Berger. He says that religion, the kind of religion that's tolerated in a secularized society, is a private religion. You're allowed to keep it in the private world, the life of leisure, of relationships, you see. Your weekends, that's where religion belongs. And what it ends up happening is all things that are meaningful, value, ethics, truth, beauty, religion, it's all found in the private world. And that means that personal identity and personal meaning is found in the private life, not the public life. Now, I'm going to get into I'm going to get into something that I'm really bad at. That's artwork. Let me see if I can do this here properly. Look. You see, the old idea was that there was a larger world that defined and gave meaning. Here's your public life, you see, and around it your private world. So you have different, there was a distinction between, say, family life, you know, out here. See, here's your public arena, your work life, and your different private lives. But as Peter Berger would say, in former times, no matter what your worldview was, before modern secularization, there was an overarching set of values that gave all of the parts of your life meaning. Your values were the same in your public life as in your private life, in your family life as in church, as in community, as in business, and so on, all right? And you generally, frankly, found your meaning in your work, in your public life. Now that's not true. I put it this way. You used to live in order to work. Now you work in order to live. You used to live, used to rest and have, you know, in order to get out there and work and accomplish something. Usually accomplishing something meaning finding your, you found purpose in life by accomplishing something that had to do with the overarching values, you see. Fulfilling the overarching values and purposes that gave definition to the common sense world. But now, that's not true. Instead, you find your purpose in the private world, in life and relationships. You work only to get enough money so you can retreat, and that's where you find your meaning. That's where you find your identity. That's the reason why the modern world is not only the most experience-oriented world, but it's the most leisure-oriented world. There has been an unbelievable explosion. I'm not that old a person. But it's astonishing to see the explosion of the entertainment industry, the movie industry, the health spa industry, you see, I mean, the sporting industry. The amount of money people put into leisure is absolutely astonishing. That's because it's the private world where you find your meaning and where you find your identity, okay? By the way, somebody said that's the reason why we have an age of boredom, because as C.E.M. Jode once has said, work is the only activity yet invented that man has been able to endure in any but the smallest possible doses. So the point is, privatization means, where does religion fit? It's okay if it fits into private life. Let me move on to pluralization, then I can give you an overview. These are all interrelated. They really are. My pluralization, let me see this. I have to do some artwork again. My pluralization, because there is no overarching value that holds all of your different worlds together. Now listen. Therefore, there's a lot of friction between the dissonant purposes and values of each arena. Your family life, your business life, your community life, they all operate upon different purposes and values. And so what you've got is, because you've lost this up here, what you really have, here's your public life, and here's all your different private worlds, you see, and they're all separate, they're not held together. At one point, okay, we said, a person found their meaning out there in finding purpose in accomplishing things in life that fit in with the purposes and values of the larger world. Now, you don't find, here's your public life, see, and here's all your private worlds, you find your meaning out here. You see, you find your meaning out here, in the private world. Now, this is interesting. Peter Berger, let me quote this. In pre-modern societies, individuals experience the world in a much more coherent way. Because of the plurality of social worlds in our modern society, each world is experienced as relatively unstable and unreliable. Okay? Because of all the different values. Each world is experienced as relatively unstable and unreliable. Thus, institutional order undergoes a loss of reality. The individual experience of himself is more real than his experience of any social world. Therefore, the individual seeks to find his foothold in reality in himself rather than outside of himself. Let me say that another way. Because the individual he's a different person everywhere, you see, like Joyce Davenport. A totally different person. If you ever watch Hill Street Blues, you know that she's a defense attorney, and she goes tooth and nail against Frank, who's a police officer, all the time, you know, in the public life, and then in the private life she jumps into bed with him. See, it's a perfect illustration of what we're trying to talk about here, all right? What happens is, because of all that dissonance, because every world is so different, the individual, it says, Peter Berger says, the individual is more real to himself than any of his social worlds, and that means than any of his social roles. And therefore, the individual finds his foothold in reality in himself instead of out there. And then Berger uses this as an illustration. He says, there's a big difference between the old concept of honor and the new concept of dignity. Honor was something you had in your covenantal social role. You see, I have honor as a man, or as a woman, or as a father, or as a husband, or as a citizen, you see, or as a public official. The concept of dignity is my freedom to not be bound by any social role, or any institution, or any covenant, or any obligation. It's my freedom, right, to be more real to myself than any of those other social worlds, which means I can pick them up and turn them around. Dignity means my right to fulfill myself any way I see fit, and no one has any right to tell me that I can't choose. That's dignity. That's different than honor. See, in honor, you found your identity outside yourself in the social world or a social role. Dignity means I find my meaning this way, by being free from any other obligation other than to do what makes me feel the best and fulfills me. That's the reason why MasterCard says personal choice. That's why I use it. Because I want options. That's the reason why the pro-abortionist people are not saying they're pro-abortionists and they're pro-choice. That's the reason for the divorce revolution. That's the reason for the midlife crisis. That's a modern phenomenon. You know what it is? We are, because we're modernized, because we're pluralized, we believe we only have meaning if we've got choices. That's the reason why half of the males in this room experience incredible fear when they realize, I may be getting serious with this girl. My options are being cut off. That's the reason why a 45-year-old man, you see, until you're about 45, you can sort of tell yourself, well, there's all these options out there. Who knows what'll happen? But you get to the top of the mountain at some point, and you can see it all the way to the end of your life, and you say, you know what, this is pretty much it. this is pretty much everything that's going to happen to me, and you can't take that, because you see, modern man finds his meaning in being able to be free to choose anything he wants. And he finds his meaning in his ability to break any covenant he sees fit. That's what's behind the midlife crisis. What he does is he exercises options. I've seen it. Buy a red sports car, dump the wife, find somebody else, wear gold chains around the neck and that kind of thing. You haven't seen that? It's ludicrous. That's the reason behind the whole rationale behind gay liberation, of course. You have to be free to choose. Why? Because dignity means you're more real than any of the social worlds around you. And the reason you're more real than any of the social worlds is there's no value structure that gives coherence to the whole thing. So remember, Berger says, in pre-modern societies, you experienced the whole world more coherently. Because of the plurality of social worlds in modern society, each world is experienced as relatively unstable. And the individual finds his foothold in reality in himself rather than outside of himself. Therefore, let me put it like this to you. Modern man, his identity is rootless and open, and he has an enormous capacity for social transformation. We change jobs, you change spouses, you change regions, you change regions of the country. It's unbelievable. And actually, people need that, because that's how they find meaning, you see. Their meaning is totally privatized in the private world, where I am free to do to have all these options, and I am free from any covenantal obligation. That's the only place I can find my meaning. Now, as a result of that, by the way, modern man is unbelievably conversion prone, right? I don't want to jump at every one of these. At every one of these points, you start to have to say, what does that say to us? When we think of ministry, we think of how the church is supposed to operate. What does that say to us? I'll tell you one thing. It does say this: that modern man is extremely conversion prone, but he's virtually commitment proof. He's conversion prone and commitment proof. You see, it's very easy to get somebody to make a decision for Christ. It's just like falling off a log. I'm sorry. You know, people want to be enriched. You know, people want God's help to get to their goals. You know. But as far as actually thoroughgoing commitment, that's one thing that they're absolutely—you're commitment proof, because the whole idea, modern concept of identity, is that I am the most important thing, and my freedom to choose is more important than what I am, actually, socially, or covenantally, or anything like that. Therefore, what does that say to us? Well, there's a lot of things that it says to us, but one of the things it says to us is church growth is easy. To a certain extent, and to another extent, it's probably harder than ever. Now, let me, before leaving this, and I want to take some questions, because everything else I'm going to show you, the radical individualism, the entrepreneurial explosion, the leadership vacuum, the dominance of the media, the single surge, all kinds of things, they all flow out of this. Let me just tell you, though, some of your little brains are starting to spin around. They're saying, this is an interesting worldview you're telling me. Now, what kind of worldview is this? Maybe you've read all these Christian books that give you these catalogs of worldviews. Is this hedonism? Is this existentialism? Is this naturalism? Is this monism? You know, you can get the catalogs. You can get the Ivy Press book, The Universe Next Door. You can get R.C.'s book, Life Worlds. Is that it? The name of that book? Now, the problem with that is this doesn't fit like that. Presbyterians in particular have always tended to do cultural critiques using intellectual history. They take these different abstract systems and they say, well, now which one's operating here? But there's more than one way to do a cultural critique. Oz Guinness points that out. Just to understand a culture, he says you've got at least three tools. One is intellectual history, one is anthropology, and one is sociology of knowledge. But what he means by that is, the way in which people are secularized is not just by an intellectual exercise. They don't sit down in a room and say, huh, this is much better than the old Christian worldview. It's a social process. They pick it up at work. They pick it up in institutions that teach professionalism. They pick it up from just the spirit of technique, you know, the technological society. They pick it up from the media and so on. The three things he mentions are, he says, to understand society, you need to use intellectual history and anthropology and sociology of knowledge. But now look, what is this worldview? You can see the intellectual roots of it. but it's more complicated than that. You can see, for example, some of you say, ah, this sounds like Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant, and look, there's the roots are in there. Immanuel Kant said there's the noumenal world and the phenomenal world, right? The phenomenal world is the sense world. It's the everyday common sense world. And he took everything out. He says, you know, God and truth and beauty and the thing in itself, you know, and ethics and all those things, they're removed. They're in the noumenal world. They can't be known. And what he did was he put all that stuff in the subjective world. And there's no doubt that the intellectual roots are there. And then you come later and you read modern existentialism. And when I was, just to let you know how different college world is now, when I started college my freshman year, I had to read Albert Camus' book, The Rebel, for three courses at once, Introduction to Literature, Introduction to History, and Introduction to Religion, same semester. That was an easy semester. Yeah. Well, and what he says there is, he says, the world's a cruel, horrible place. Hmm? And what does it mean to be authentically human? You shake your fist at the evil and the insanity of the world and you go down to a never-ending defeat fighting against it. In other words, good, truth, beauty is completely locked away. You see, it cannot break into the real world. And a perfect example of Camus' rebel is Don Quixote in the Man of La Mancha, right? That is a terrific existentialist manifesto. That musical, I'm not talking about the book, I'm talking about the musical. Don Quixote decides to be crazy. He decides, even though it's a modern age, he's going to be a knight and he's going to go off and he's going to fight dragons and rescue fair damsels, and somebody comes up to him and says, you're out of touch with reality and the facts. And this is what he says. He says, facts are the enemy of truth, right? And then he says, I've seen life as it is. I've seen men dying in battle. I've seen men dying under the lash. And they don't ask themselves, why did I die? But they say, why did I live? And then he says, if life itself is lunatic, who's to say where madness lies? And then finally, he says, maybe too much sanity is madness, and maddest of all to see life as it is and not as it ought to be. A concrete slab between the ideal and the real, between the noumenal and the phenomenal, you see. It's a concrete slab and there's no way over it. Now, he said, you know, he sings about the impossible dream, to march into hell for a heavenly cause. Now, let me just say this. I would take a good old-fashioned atheistic existentialist any day of the week over secularized modern man. I mean, there was something, even from a Christian point of view, there was something noble about that. And I happen to know that emotionally, at least, those people were prepared for Christianity. You could preach to them because you could say, listen, the ideal did become real, you see. There was one person, Jesus Christ, who did march into hell for a heavenly cause. There's a big wall there, but there's a door through the wall, you see. The noumenal became phenomenal. There's a way to do this. There's a way to deal with this. The good old atheistic guys, like C.S. Lewis was one like that. He lived in the myth world. He read myths, and in that world, he experienced glory and experienced truth and beauty, but he didn't believe that could ever break in. And you know the way J.R.R. Tolkien led Lewis to Christ. It's in Tolkien's biography. At one point, they're talking about this, and Lewis, who's still an atheist, says, yes, but myths are lies, though breathed through silver. And you see, there's the concrete slab there, and then Tolkien said, no, they are not. And that was he says, there's a myth that became fact, you see. There's a myth that broke into history. There's, you know, the noumenal broke into the phenomenal and so on. You could talk to a Lewis, you can even talk, you know, frankly, to a good atheistic existentialist, but what has happened now? See, secularization has taken that old, mistaken worldview, and it's come on down, and it's a real distorted, wimpy perversion of good old-fashioned existentialism. You see, you've got religion and truth and beauty is totally in the private realm, but what do we go into the public realm for? Not to march into hell for a heavenly cause? Not to go in there and go down to a never-ending defeat fighting against evil. No, you go in there to get as much money as you possibly can, to give into the self-indulgence, to basically make your killing so you can create the electronic cottage at the beach of your choice, where you can go into your hermetically sealed little private world, and that's where you find meaning, and where you're able to have enough money, basically, to use all those options, to use your MasterCard, you see. Where you can go into your hermetically sealed little private world, and that's where you find meaning, and where you're able to have enough money, basically, to use all those options, to use your MasterCard, you see, to chuck your wife and buy the red convertible if you have to. And it, the existential